is here. Let's go ahead and get started. Since Lydia's not here this morning, I'm going to go ahead and do the meeting, start introductions. We're going to start with Jessica. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, I'm Jesse. I'm the CAP board member, and I've been with the board for over
3 years. Ty Stover, City of Vancouver.
Shrieking, Moan, come rep.
Janet with Clark County.
I'm Judith, and I'm the new rep for District 2.
Michael Norris with Clark County.
Rebecca Royce, Clark County. I also wanted to introduce Avelia Johnson. She is a Clark College student. She's in a poli-sci class, and one of the requirements is to attend a public meeting. So she has graciously asked to join our meeting today. And I just wanted to give you a heads up that to prove that she was here, she has to take a picture. So she will, at some point in the meeting, take a picture of everybody to prove that she was actually in attendance.
And the paper is due today?
The picture.
I have a full-time job and a full-time school, so if I'm out of school, I'm at work.
The picture is probably due today. I should have brought some big charts and pie charts so we could all be like analyzing.
I just know because we had the last big rush at council last night.
So. Oh, okay.
Oh, gotcha.
Oh, Bridget McClayman. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm running late. So, District 3?
Two.
So we have two from District.
No, I'm two.
Oh, you two. I don't know. We're good. I know we're good.
Community member.
Yes.
Community. Go with that.
Thank you.
Mavis Nichols from Battleground.
And Paula Martin, community member from downtown. That was easy. Now, everybody should have got a copy, either electronically or on paper, of the minutes from last month's, or last time's meeting in March.
I move the approval of the minutes.
Is there a
second?
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Alrighty, then. Now we're going to... Rebecca's been explaining these new rules for nomination of the low-income members of the board. So this morning we're going to nominate Jessica, although she's been a member of the board, but we have to officially nominate her. So we've got little highlights of her resume. AmeriCorps Vista, member of the Lutheran Community Services Northwest from 2011-2014. That's how she joined the board. Diversity Retention Coordinator for Students with Disabilities at Portland Community College from 2010-2011. The CAB member since 2013, representing low-income community. Based on her knowledge of Vista and working with refugees, she has completed her Bachelor of Arts degree at Washington State University. Sounds like a very challenging program, and is going to possibly stay with AmeriCorps, right?
Perfect.
Awesome. So, do we have a motion to nominate Jessica to remain on the CAB board?
I will still move.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Welcome to the board again. And Rebecca's going to review the draft report to the committee.
So every year we put out a report about what we did the previous year called the Community Action Report to the Community. We've used the same kind of format for the last few years to stay consistent with the last RFA, request for application process that we did. Next year you'll see probably a pretty big revamp of the entire report itself. Basically we have from the director section in the beginning to talk about what the report really is and highlight a couple of the programs that we've done. And then as you work your way through the report, you'll see information about the Community Action Advisory Board. There's a section from the board chair that Lydia sent in for us, some information about what community action is and what our promise is as a community action agency. There's a high-level overview of the funding that we receive that the board oversees and distributes through those requests for applications. And then they're broken down into sections. So there's access, so what kind of programs can help people access services. So we have the Council for the Homeless Housing Solutions Center, the Janus Youth Programs, their PERCH, and their Yellow Brick Road Outreach Program. And so interspersed with each of these headings is some miscellaneous information. For example, under health, we have a little highlight of what the food bank has done through their Fresh Alliance program, and what the vacancy rate was for 2015. All of this information is about last year, so that's kind of one of the important things to keep in mind. So we have some pretty charts throughout to make it interesting to look at, and several success stories intertwined that our agencies have provided to us so that we can show just what impact is happening in our community because of the programs that we have been funding. Towards the back of the report I pulled in some of those charts that I presented at the retreat about what poverty looks like here in Clark County, because we thought that was really good, interesting information to kind of throw in. So there's some information there. And then we kept the community needs survey data, and we just wanted to be a reminder that this is from our last survey in 2013, and we're currently working on our next community needs assessment. We have our task force that's working together. We have a new survey completely revamped. It's been drafted, and I'll be presenting that to the task force at our next meeting. But that's where this information here comes from, so it's a little bit on the older data side, but still relevant for the programs that were funded through 2015. And then we list out a lot of the partnerships that we work with through all the programs, different coalitions and public meetings that we go to, just the partnerships that we work on or work with throughout the year, and then contact information at the very back of the report. So we present this information for you to review, and if there's any questions that you have about information that's in here or the way something's formatted, anything like that, we welcome your feedback. And then we'll take a look at that, incorporate what we can into the report, and then we'll bring it back to you at the July meeting for formal adoption. Once that's done, we will send it to all of the CAB members, a final draft, and then we send it out to all of the agencies that we partner with, and we broadcast it out so that people can see what good work the CAB has been doing with the Department of Community Services.
I have one question. Are
yes.
all the partnerships things we fund, or just they could be other kinds of partnerships?
Other kinds. So there's a lot of the agencies that we fund are definitely there, but you'll see that I believe ABC, Metropolitan Services should be listed. They oversee the ABC, the Asset Building Coalition meetings, and I attend those because we fund an asset building program, and so that's why they're listed. So there's, as long as there's a linkage there, then we could.
A real linkage. You know, like
yes. It has to be tangible. We don't just throw everybody in there. It would be 5 pages long just for the partnerships. But as long as there is, yes, some sort of working together that to make that partnership. Any other questions about the report?
I think it's pretty impressive.
Thank you.
Rebecca has really been working hard on it for the past couple weeks.
So if you have anything that comes to you after the meeting, feel free to send me an email, and we'll make sure that we take a look at that, see what we can do. One of the things that we really wanted to keep in mind with this version of the report is the length, and to make sure that it's not heavily worded. So it's not, if we want it to be easy, something that you just look at and you can get an idea of what's being said and what we've done in 2015.
So, very small, on the listing of board members.
Yes.
There's an extra tab in front of Councilwoman.
Oh,
Ellen
that's Mecklen. An extra space. Thank
yeah.
you. And that's why we always have several eyes looking at it.
updates. Jessica's going to go first on advocacy efforts.
So I am chairing the advocacy task force. And so we basically have been discussing what advocacy means in terms for us as a task force and as CAB, and we came up with the definition that it basically means to be engaged in the community through a diverse amount of different actions, whereas contacting representatives via email or telephone, and just different ways to be involved in the community and educating the community, where it's workshops or coming to community meetings. And we discuss goals for each one of us, monthly goals to advocate in the community, and to create the survey to get feedback from you guys to find out what you thought of this CAB and also what you'd like to see come about with the advocacy task force. And so that's what we've been doing so far. Is there anything else?
No, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
Did everybody get a chance to try out the little reporting thing online?
The survey online.
Everybody, you sent that to everybody, right?
Kate, yeah, that should have gone out for everyone. And Kate was wanting to get some feedback on if it worked for you. Was it easy? Was it not? Do you want more reminders, less reminders? It's the reporting, the survey is used for required reporting for the Washington State Community Action Partnership. So they send it to us quarterly, which is why we ask you and why we ask so many questions, because it's a not fun Excel spreadsheet report that we have to submit to WASCAP. Otherwise, we wouldn't.
Did everybody get a chance to try that out?
So, how often are you sending it? I had a hard time finding it. So, it would be much better if it was monthly or something. So, I had a hard time even thinking that far.
Sure.
Because otherwise, we have to track it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some more examples of the sort of thing you're counting would have helped me. I wasn't sure what to report on.
Yeah, and you sent an email that was fantastic. When we had sent out the just the FYI regarding the Vancouver Council meeting workshop, Bridget had sent an email asking, does this count for advocacy? And we said, yes!
Absolutely.
So that's how easy it was. All she did was she took it and posted it on her Facebook page. And so her 30 seconds. And so that was how easy it was for her to do an advocacy effort.
Was that the red shirt?
Were you there?
I wasn't able to be there, but I sent out the information. One of my responsibilities as chair is to give out information about all the possible ways to advocate. So that was one of the things.
I went.
Thanks.
Yeah, I had to ask because I couldn't be there either.
So do you send that out to everybody or just to the people?
So I send it out to, I sent a bunch of information out to Kate. Kate graciously sent out information to everyone else.
Yeah, and we have that filtering through me.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason for that is we've gotten some feedback that we have different emails coming from different people.
We don't
want to
overwhelm everyone.
So we carefully weigh what we want to send out because we want to make sure that you're not just filtering through emails that say my name on them, but also to be able to search back and look. You see if you know that it's CAB related, that it's come from me. So that way you can easily search your emails. And yes, we want to make sure. Not that we want to filter in that sense of we want you to advocate and we want you to attend as many things as possible. I just don't want you to see my email coming out every 10 minutes. So,
but if it's shown, people start ignoring it.
Yes.
Is that including things like fundraisers for food banks, that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Is that advocacy?
To attend?
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't it be?
I don't know why it wouldn't.
If you're supporting your advocacy, you can advocate with dollars just as well as you can with your mouth.
I like the idea, though, possibly putting something together that really says, with more examples of what advocacy could be. So
I think we're working on that.
Good.
In the realm, I would, Yeah, I'm just very difficult for me to figure out when I'm advocating versus.
Yeah.
You know, I sit on the board of Daybreak Youth Services, which is not something that we're directly involved in, but it's within the overall.
And it doesn't have to be. And that's, I think, one of the hard times that we had talking with Kate about what advocacy is and what we want to forward onto the board. If everybody has a special interest, and that's what makes this board so important, is that everybody has a focus that they really do enjoy working with and advocating for. As the staff of the board, we could inundate you with opportunities to advocate, if we were trying to meet everybody's focus. And so basically what I'm saying is that it doesn't have to be something that we're funding. As long as you're advocating for somebody or that meets the criteria of community action, which essentially is somebody that's low income in our community, that's the only criteria.
Issues of poverty, economic security. You know, if that's the activity area that you are being an activist in, you know, you can count it as advocacy for community action, even if it's not a program that this group is directly funding.
So, Daybreak, drugs and alcohol are not exclusively a low income, but they are a
correct. And there is a subject, an individual's subjective call in that. And I don't, on the most part, I don't think anyone here will have an intention of arguing like what you just did is not advocacy. It doesn't count. I think the most we would do in terms of filtering, and it shouldn't change your activities, but in terms of our reporting to WASCAP, to the Washington State Community Action Partnership, they're really looking for in their spreadsheet is legislative advocacy. You know, so anything that you report to us that we put on that spreadsheet will probably be focused on legislative advocacy. If anything you're doing is not reflected in there, that's why. We're just reporting what their focus is. If it's not, it shouldn't stop you from engaging in those activities in any way, and please don't let it stop you from letting us know the activities you're doing. And our only interest in knowing what those activities are is just so we, can count that as something the board is doing. It's not a limiting, it's not a censoring, it's not a control piece. You know, it's just a tracking piece so we can count it in any way that we can.
Which is why we came up as a task force with a few examples, such as contacting by phone, email, legislators, attending community events and whatnot, fundraising events, and coming up with monthly goals for each of us.
And we don't want to filter what you're reporting as advocacy. What we're filtering is all of the inundation of emails about events and opportunities.
Well, the opposite though is this is a time consuming effort, and knowing specifically what you need is, mm-hmm. So if it's legislating, then I'm primarily going to be looking at when I'm going up mm-hmm. the chain. And so I wouldn't send you something about activities with Daybreak because I'm not contact real.
You could be.
Just use your judgment.
It's not a science. It's not a specific science. If you feel like you were advocating for something that would fall under a community action program, which is far and wide, and that it may be benefiting somebody who is low income. And you feel it's advocacy, then we want you to reach out.
And both Kate and you are really good about letting us know what falls in that realm.
So when I have that happen, speaking
Are you serious, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
County council meetings.
County council, not city. But recently they were attacking the new fourth plan, mm-hmm. healthy communities thing. And so I was talking about that and I said, I'm a member of CAP, but I'm not speaking for CAP. And I didn't know if there was a point, like a couple of weeks before you'd been there with the volunteer lawyers program. And
or a human service fund.
Yeah, so I wonder if that's just the appropriate way, since I don't have permission of the body to say whatever I'd
I think
say.
That's okay.
Yeah, I think that was perfect.
Yeah.
Unless there's a discussion, and you know, we can take that directly to the executive team if it's in between meetings, things
yeah.
like that, to see if that's something they want to support. But I think that is the right approach to take. Although I am a CAB member, I'm not here advocating on their behalf.
But then I report.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
But you're totally
yeah.
fine that you're reporting
okay.
because you were advocating for that program.
Okay.
And that's perfectly fine.
And keep speaking up. Somebody has to talk to them.
So it sounds like one of the other questions that Kate has was, what does the group need to support their advocacy and how the task force can play that role? So it looks like having some sort of examples and stuff is a big
one. Me coming up pretty quick, don't we?
Examples and parameters is what I'm hearing.
Okay, so we'll work on that. We'll focus on that next meeting.
Could I make a general request about emails? It would really help me if it said CAB in the subject line and then a dash for whatever the topic is.
Yeah.
I find I'm losing.
Yeah, and I'm not sure why you don't get the PDF documents. That's odd.
No idea.
Yes, I will make a concerted effort to make sure that it always says CAP. Is there anything on the advocacy task force? I'll get this information.
Right through that. Okay. Now Bridget's turn to get us up to date on the community needs assessment.
I confess I've forgotten. I said that. Lead this until I looked at the agenda for today. So I'm going to have to hand it over to Rebecca to talk about it. But we had one meeting, and what we were talking about was the survey and how to reach more people. Some concern that we get distorted results when we use easy to use places to reach out to families. So that and the next meeting is coming up. I don't know where, because I've lost the email. But
May 31st will be our next meeting. And we'll have the draft surveys. We actually have two different surveys we're doing this year, so this is new. We're doing one that's specifically for low-income individuals, and we have one for our providers to kind of get their take on what the needs are. So they're a little bit different. And like I mentioned earlier, we've totally revamped the survey from what we've done in the past, so we hope that to use in our assessment.
And anybody can come to those task force meetings if there's a particular interest in helping us look at those surveys and stuff.
Yeah, it would be good.
More eyes, the better.
Yeah.
So the big thing we'll be talking about this next meeting is really looking at the list of who we're going to be sending out the surveys to. They're available, they will be available online along with hard copies, and we always provide paid return envelopes for each of them, so to reduce any barriers of getting those surveys back from as many people as we possibly can.
What time is that meeting?
2:30.
I believe it is 2:30 on the 31st,
yeah.
And we're going to meet at the Commonwealth.
No, we're not. They're closed.
They're closed.
They went out
this weekend.
Did they really?
Yeah. Watch the move. Yeah.
We tried so hard.
I know. We tried
to go there.
Sort of. Yeah.
Okay. So we'll figure out some place else. Are you interested in being on that task force?
I don't currently have anything on my schedule that week.
So I will
put
add
it on
you.
Quickly.
I will add Ty.
Send in that message, that meeting request fast.
Yes, and we'll figure out where we would like
to go back to Latigal. It's just easy.
You want to do Latigal again?
Central, it's closed.
tried to count Commonwealth as well, but so many of my requests, the answer was no.
Yeah.
And that will not keep you in business long.
They didn't do customer service well. They weren't. They're nice guys. I liked them. We went in there a lot, tried to keep them going, but not bad.
Yeah. So it'll be May 31st at 2:30. Usually meetings take usually about an hour and a half, and we'll be at Latita. So if anybody would like to join us, that's where we will be.
Latita's right on 39th Street on the south side.
Okay.
Right past the dentist office.
Okay. Weird for pot.
Parking is about the only downside. It's usually street parking.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
And where did you say it's going to be?
Nothing. I'm sorry.
Where did you say?
At Latina.
It's on 39th Street.
It's about two blocks down from Main Street.
It's right by the dentist office.
Would you like me to add you to that list also?
Yeah. For a while, it would be helpful to get more rather than less because I don't really know all the.
Actually, that would be great. Yeah. Actually, having new thoughts, new eyes is a great idea.
Fantastic.
Should I skip over the point in time count?
Since Dale's not here, why don't we skip him and
go right to Susan? All right. Volunteer Lawyers is here with Susan Arnie.
Hi,
Susan.
Thank you so much for asking me to come speak to you. I'd love to speak about my program. And I didn't prepare a formal presentation for you. I wanted to just have a discussion with you. I prepared some notes. Unfortunately, I have about an hour and a half worth of notes, so do cut me off when the time comes. I know there's a lot of faces here that I don't know. I've been with the Volunteer Lawyer Program since 2004, and I've been to many of your meetings, but it's great to see new faces and new people. And Bridget, it's great to see you. Thank you. I know Bridget from past...
Way back.
I'd like to give you a little history about the Volunteer Lawyer Program, who we are, talk a little bit about our grants and our funding, tell you a little bit about what we do, some of the other programs that are in Clark County that work with us, what our plans and next steps are, and then if we have time, I have a few client stories for you. So, the Volunteer Lawyer Program was incorporated in 1990 as a result of the federal government deciding to start funding legal aid. They passed a law that allowed the interest on lawyer trust accounts to be collected and pooled into what's called IOLTA, interest on lawyer trust accounts, and used for legal aid to help low-income people with civil legal matters. Interestingly enough, in our country, if you have a criminal issue, you are entitled to a free attorney, a public defender. But if it's a civil legal issue, you are not. There is no free attorney for you. There is no help other than legal aid. In Clark County, the attorneys in the Bar Association had been doing pro bono services through the Bar Association for many years. As near as I can tell back, as far as the 1970s, there were programs available. But in 1990, with the funding available, we did incorporate and become a nonprofit to serve low-income people. And we do serve low-income people in civil matters in Clark County courts. Our funding is primarily through grants, not primarily, exclusively through grants. When they set up the IOLTA Fund, they set up the Legal Foundation of Washington to handle that money. And that IOLTA money, because interest rates have dropped so dramatically, that money has evaporated. In 2007, in the state of Washington, they raised almost $9 million in IOLTA money. Last year, we raised less than $1 million. That funds 19 programs throughout the state of Washington. The Legal Foundation, in response to that, has reached out to other funding resources and has set up the Campaign for Equal Justice, which is a fundraising effort that reaches out to the private bar to try to raise private donations. But as a result, our funding from the Legal Foundation has dropped considerably over the years. Clark County has funded us. I looked back in my records, and we had a grant from Clark County in 1990, the year we incorporated. And it looks like every year since the year 2000, for every single year, Clark County has supported us and given us a grant. So you have been our major funding source since the beginning of our funding. Last year, this year, Clark County has given us $75,000. Legal Foundation gave us about $40,000. And we've done some private fundraising to raise about $10,000. So we operate our program on a budget of a little over $100,000 a year. What we do, the state of Washington, we're part of a state alliance of legal aid providers. We work very closely with the state to make sure that we meet best practices and that we operate in a way that matches what the state feels is the priorities. The state Supreme Court commissioned the Civil Legal Needs Study, which was a survey of low-income households and service providers to see what the legal issues were. And one of the primary legal issues they found was legal literacy. Low-income people don't know what their legal problems are. They don't know that there's help available. Other things they found, there was a change. They had done the survey in 2003, and the primary legal issue in 2003 was family law. They changed the way they did the survey, and this year they found that primary legal issues were health care issues, employment issues, and then family law and housing. What the study didn't do was prioritize what was the most important legal issue you have. They found that low-income people have multiple legal issues. But we find in our program that the primary issue we're hearing about, we hear about all of them, but the primary one we hear about is family law. So things that we do in our program, people come to us with civil legal issues. We operate our program with volunteer attorneys. We do not pay any of our attorneys. They get a virtual chocolate chip cookie from me. It's no calories. It comes via email. And a lot of thank yous. I have about 230 attorneys in Clark County that volunteer for me. In any given year, about 125 of them actually provide services. The services we provide are primarily what we call advice appointments. A client can come in for a 30-minute appointment with an attorney and get advice. They can come back for multiple appointments so we can walk them through their entire legal issue. So, for instance, in family law, if a client was wanting to file for a divorce, maybe there was domestic violence involved and they needed to get out of the situation, they would come to us, talk to an attorney, we would determine which legal forms they needed, provide those to them, ask them to go away and fill them out. They would come back, an attorney would look those forms over, help them complete them. Then we would give them instructions about how to go to court, how to attend the hearing, and how to file the paperwork. In family law, there's multiple court appearances, so the client would probably come back and get advice about the next court appearance, until we get them entirely through the process and they get the divorce. We have a number of Spanish-speaking clients, so we have an attorney who speaks fluent Spanish and is a family law attorney who gives a family law advice clinic in Spanish for our Spanish-speaking clients. For other people with barriers, language barriers to the court system, we provide interpreters. Part of our budget is dedicated to paying for in-person interpreters for our clients. We also do work in bankruptcy for low-income people. Often they have huge medical debt that they can't pay, and bankruptcy is a solution for them. So particularly if they're facing garnishment, they're low-income, they're at low-paying jobs, garnishment can cripple them financially. We have attorneys who will actually do the entire bankruptcy for them. The other area that we do a lot of work in is what we call our Housing Justice Project. It's an eviction program. We help low-income people who are being evicted. We work in partnership with the Council for the Homeless with that, and often what we find is they haven't been able to pay the rent. Maybe somebody's lost a job, or they've had other debts that they've been having to pay, and they're unable to pay their rent. We can't stop the eviction. If you can't pay your rent, you will be evicted. But what we're able to do is work with the landlord or the landlord's attorney and reduce the fees. Often when they you're evicted and you end up going to court, the landlord will charge you for his attorney fees and other costs that he has incurred. We'll get those waived. We'll get the landlord to give the client some extra time because it is difficult to find low-income housing. And a few extra weeks of tenancy can make a difference in finding that housing. We actually go to the courthouse for that program. We have volunteer attorneys who will go to the courthouse and meet with the landlord and the landlord's attorney.
Can I stop you here?
Sure.
So the city recently changed our no-fault eviction and no-fault eviction notice of rent increase
Yes.
Source of income. Have you been seeing anything?
We've seen some clients in that situation, yes. One of the things that we found is that there is a provision in that city ordinance that says that the landlord has to have 5 units. Mm-hmm. So we've seen people come to us where the landlord is an individual that has 1 unit and that doesn't apply. But we have seen cases where the landlord wasn't aware or didn't follow that rule, and we have been able to go into court and present that to the judge and get the eviction dismissed.
Do you have any tracking of that?
I don't at this time.
Okay. Are you tracking it?
No.
Mm, okay.
I certainly can't.
It would be very helpful for
okay.
us.
I will do that. Yes.
Obviously, we have no way of tracking it at the city.
Yeah. Okay. I can track what we see, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Another program that we do, we work in conjunction with the YWCA Safe Choice Program, their domestic violence shelter, and we do a legal clinic at the YWCA for domestic violence survivors to help them. The YWCA helps them get their protection order, and then we step in at that point and help them get a parenting plan, if that's what they need for their children, or get a divorce and remove them from the situation that we're in. We also do a clinic at Child Protective Services. When a family is involved in Child Protective Services, once the situation is stabilized and the children are going back to the family or to another family member, a third-party custody issue, what Child Protective Services found was that they need finalization papers. They need a parenting plan or they need a custody order through the court. And low-income people weren't able to do that on their own. And again, it's a civil matter. There's no attorney, free attorney to help with that. So we partner with them and provide attorneys to meet with their low-income clients to help them finish those final paperwork and get those final parenting plans. Parenting plans are incredibly important to families that have separated, because in the case of if they don't have a parenting plan, both parents have equal rights to the children. And if there's contention, if there's things going on in the family, one parent can come and take the children away from the other parent. And without a court order, that's perfectly okay. So by getting a parenting plan, you determine which parent is going to have the primary custody of these children, what the visitation schedule is going to be, who's going to make the decisions about these children. And then if the other parent breaks that plan, the parent can call the police, and the police have a reason to act on that, where without a parenting plan, they don't. Finally, the
there's other things we do, but these are the most important ones I wanted to tell you about. The last thing we do that is really unique to us, we're the only one in the state of Washington, and that is our homeless court. And our homeless court is a criminal activity court, sort of quasi. We're the only one in the state of Washington. We're one of about 26 nationwide. We work with district court and take homeless people and allow them to convert their misdemeanor fines into community service hours. Homeless people get a situation where they're living in their car, they've lost their driver's license because they can't pay their fines. What happens with fines in the court system is if you can't pay them at a certain point, they get turned over to a collection agency. That collection agency assesses a 35% fee and starts charging horrible interest on this. That fine just continues to grow. Homeless person can't pay it. At that point, it's reported to Department of Licensing and they lose their driver's license because of it. At that point, they're living in their car. They're dependent on their car. They're driving. They get driving with suspended license ticket. That just adds to the problem. If they don't drive their car, then they have a situation of how do you look for work, how do you find housing, and it becomes a spiraling effect. So this court allows them to take those fines out of collections. It eliminates the 35% fee, eliminates the interest, brings it back down to just the fine and the court fees, and allows them to convert the fines into community service hours. This then allows the homeless person to work these off, get their driver's license. The minute it gets pulled out of collections, they can get their driver's license back, and allows them then to start the working in the process of becoming back into society. Other programs that we work with, there is another legal aid program in Clark County. It's statewide. It's called Northwest Justice Project. They're a staffed attorney program. They have actually attorneys on staff that take what they consider high priority cases and represent most of their clients, fully represent them and go to court with them. They have family law attorneys that work in family law and work primarily with families where children are at risk because of domestic violence. They have, I believe, 1.5 family law attorneys. So their caseload is smaller, but more intense involvement with the clients. There is the CLEAR hotline, which is run by Northwest Justice Project. It's a hotline where low-income people can call and talk to an attorney over the phone. We get many referrals from that. We do ask a lot of our clients to call that number and talk to an attorney over the phone before they come to us, primarily because we're backed up. It takes a couple weeks to get into us, and that's an opportunity for them to get legal help immediately. The downside to CLEAR is because it's a state hotline, it's hard to get through to. They are continually making improvements to it. A couple years ago, they bought a whole new phone system, so it's better than it was, but it's still difficult to get through. There's a website that's done by Northwest Justice Project called Washington Law Help. It's an excellent website for legal issues. It has a lot of civil legal issues on it. It has articles about the civil legal need issue and has all the forms and the instructions on how to fill out those forms. So we often send our clients to them. Unfortunately, the forms, the instructions, and the articles are not written in what I consider plain language for a level that would be adequate for. So it's often overwhelming for our low-income clients. I do use it to train my new attorneys. When I have a brand new attorney who's just passed the bar and comes to our program, we train those attorneys, and I say, look, go to Washington Law Help. It tells you all the instructions on how to fill out the form, so I can use it for that. There is a new web program that just started this year called Washington Web Lawyer. It allows a low-income person to go on the web, post a question, a legal question, and then volunteer attorneys throughout the state will log into that website and can answer that question over the web. It's a limited service. You can't get a lot of, it's for mostly easy questions, simple questions. But we find we get phone calls often with people who say, I just have a little question, how can I get it answered? We can't answer it in our office because we don't have staff attorneys that can answer it. So we can send them to Washington Web Lawyer.
And that's wawweblawyer.org.
Yeah, wawweblawyer.org. Next steps, things that are happening in our program. We did get a significant increase in our funding this year from Clark County, and thank you very much for that. It is partly in response to the new requirements from the county that we track everything in HMIS.
He's the HMIS guy.
He's
the
HMIS
guy. No, you can blame him.
You can blame me.
No, I'm not. Dale had nothing to do with it. No, it wasn't Dale. I think it was the federal government. I think it was those guys. We collect all our data in a statewide system called Legal Server. So this is meaning that we're having to duplicate our data collection efforts, which is fine. I don't mind doing that, but it did require some additional staff to do that. The other thing that not only the state of Washington, but Clark County is recommending and we are doing is we are tracking outcomes now. We have always tracked outputs. Those are easy to track. You just count the numbers of things and it's fine. But we have instituted methods now of collecting outcomes. Much more labor intensive to do that. It means tracking our clients much more closely. And we often don't see our clients at the end of their legal issue, so it means contacting them and finding that out or going to the court records. So we are doing those things. The big news for our program, and this is down the road a little bit, but I've been with the program since 2004, and I'm going to retire. Yeah, I know, it's horrible. Yeah. Everybody said you can't go. Well, look, guys, I really am ready to do this. I'm not planning to retire till the end of 2017, so another year and a half. And I'm working very closely with my board of directors to plan this retirement, make it as smooth as possible, and help them find somebody that best meets the program's needs and can carry on the program. I'm very dedicated to this program. I've put a lot into it over the years, and I do want it to succeed and go on and grow and be even more successful. Other things that we're looking at, we are working with Clark County Superior Court to develop a program where we have, similar to our eviction program, where we have attorneys in the courthouse. We want to do that with family law. The family law docket at the courthouse is huge. They have three courtrooms running with probably 30 clients in each courtroom twice a week, every week. And many of those clients are pro se, which means they don't have an attorney representing them. They're doing it on their own. They don't know which forms to use. They don't know court procedure. They get in there. The commissioner or the judge that's presiding can't tell them. That's not allowed to give advice from the bench. So these people come back over and over again and are doing it incorrectly. So we're working with them to provide attorneys to be at the courthouse so that when we see someone applying in that situation, they can come to us. We'll screen them for eligibility for our program and then be able to provide an attorney to see that they have the right paperwork or that it is filled out properly or that they understand what their next step is and what they need to do. So we're working on that. There's a program in Cowlitz County where they are doing that on a much smaller scale. We're communicating with both the court and the program up there to find out how we do that. The other area we're looking at growing in is wills and estates probate. We're aware of the fact that the Lukey Senior Center has a legal clinic that helps seniors with these types of issues. But they've had a change in the lawyers that are participating in that. They had two lawyers doing that. One of them was in a very bad accident and is no longer available to do that. The other one retired. They do have one attorney who's going down there and helping people, but we understand now there is a 3 to 6 month waiting list to get in there. So we feel that this is an area where we can step in and help meet that need, and we do get a number of phone calls about that, and it's an area we haven't provided services in the past, so we're looking to start providing those services. Somewhat contingent on staffing, if we can set up our staff in such a way that we can handle that. So those are the things we're looking at expanding into at this time. There's huge need in the community. We don't meet the need by any means. We probably meet less than 20% of the need in the county with our programs. Partly people aren't coming to us because they don't know they have a legal need. They don't know about us. One of the things that I haven't done a very good job at, given the time, I'd like to do more outreach in the community. But at this time, we don't have the capacity to increase significantly at any rate. If I have a few minutes left, want to give you some client stories. These are from 2014. In 2014, our family law programs assisted 273 clients. One of those was a DV victim who successfully got her abuser out of her home, got a divorce, and a court-ordered permanent protection order. She now has a safe home for her and her children. She will make no more trips to the emergency room. After months of fighting, much arguing and screaming, during which the children hid in their room with pillows over their head, these parents, this is a different case, these parents now have a court-ordered parenting plan. There's no more parental conflict, and the children are doing much better in school. Studies have found that parental conflict affects the children dramatically, reduces their schooling. They often miss school, so a parenting plan can help out. Our Housing Justice Project, our eviction program, assisted 203 clients in 2014. One of those was a father of four who had lost his job. His wife's income at a part-time job and his unemployment did not cover his household expenses. He couldn't pay all his rent. The landlord worked with him for 2 months, then gave him a 3-day eviction notice. The parents came to court not knowing what to do, how to find new low-income housing with an eviction on their record. A volunteer attorney was able to work with the landlord and get another month of tenancy for them. The family was directed to the Salvation Army and the Council for the Homeless. They were able to find housing, and 2 adults and 4 children did not end up on the streets. In bankruptcy, we assisted 53 clients. We completed 33 bankruptcy proceedings. One of them was a young man with a minimum wage job who had $10,000 in debt. His creditors had been hounding him, and one of them began garnishing his wages. The young man contemplated quitting his job and working under the table to make ends meet. He called the volunteer lawyer program to find out his options. A volunteer attorney filed bankruptcy for this client and stopped the garnishment. The young man kept his job and has a chance to start over. In 2014, 27 homeless persons had $90,219 worth of fines converted to 8,696 hours of community service with 3,707 jail days saved. These are jail days that were not needed because they were waived. Because of homeless court, a homeless woman was able to get her driver's license back and then found a job. She converted $3,115 of fines to 332 hours of community service. She now has her daughter with her, has a job and an apartment, and is enrolled part-time in school.
Awesome story, Susan. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the program, too. It does an awesome job.
Anything else you'd like to know?
All your 200-some lawyers family law?
Oh, no.
No, they just...
No. Yeah. We have, we have bankruptcy, family law, general law, guardianship, non-parental custody. The only thing we don't have is criminal attorneys. They won't volunteer for me. They say, I know nothing about family law. And the government attorneys don't volunteer for me. The prosecutors, censure me on, those attorneys don't volunteer for me. But the rest of the attorneys come from a wide range of legal areas.
Can you pass out? You're on.
I did bring a few things with me for you.
Do you have any funding from the city?
We have in the past a few times gotten funding from the city. When did we get our last one? 2013, I believe we had a grant. In 2014, we didn't meet their priorities. Their priorities were funding mostly homeless services, and we didn't meet their priorities. Unfortunately, legal aid doesn't meet priorities. We're not directly serving children. We're not directly in education. We're not directly feeding the homeless or housing the homeless. So we have to get creative about how we meet the priorities of the various programs. The other thing about funding is that often one of the reasons that the Clark County grant is so important to us and the Legal Foundation grant is so important to us is they are ongoing funding that funds operational expenses. A lot of funding, grant sources, we do get funding. We've gotten funding from Community Foundation of Southwest Washington many years. So that's a small funding source. But those funding sources often want to fund a startup project. They will fund it for 1 to 3 years, and then they expect you to fund it out of your own funds after that. And what you do. We have no other funding unless we can increase our Clark County grant to cover that new project. So that the Clark County grant and the Legal Foundation grant are our primary sources of ongoing funding.
I was just thinking that community mediation services used to be funded out of a percentage of some court fee or whatever, so it was a stable ongoing source. It was cut back when the economy tanked, but the economy is untanking, and it might be interesting to look at.
We do get some state funding. State funding comes with restrictions on. And this is the nice thing about Legal Foundation funding. There's no restrictions on it. We don't get any federal funding because that all goes to Northwest Justice Project because they live with the restrictions. And the state of Washington has determined that they wanted a set of programs available that didn't have the restrictions of those funding sources. Mm-hmm. So we do get, through Northwest Justice Project, a small amount of state funding every year. That comes to us through the Legal Foundation as part of our grant. But yeah, I often look for other funding sources. We have gotten some of those, but they tend to be small one-time grants. So I did give you a bookmark for Washington Law Help, so if you have a legal issue you want to explore, go on there and look for it. I gave you my business card if you have any questions or if you'd like to come down and see our program. We'd love to have you. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Susan. Thank you so much.
Well, Dale's here. I guess we'll let him
go next. Hi, everybody. My name is Dale Whitley. I'm the HMIS Administrator with the Council for the Homeless. So if anybody doesn't know, HMIS stands for Homeless Management Information System. So all of our emergency shelters and transitional housing programs and service organizations like the volunteer lawyers, they integrate it into the HMIS. So I coordinate the annual point in time count, and that's what I'm here to share today, is our 2016 point in time count. So if everybody has the handout, just to back up a little bit. So the point in time count is required by HUD every year during the last week of January. And unlike the annual, or not the annual, but the national census, where they have months to do this, we are directed to just on one day try and count as many people as we can. So it's just a snapshot of that one day. So it's important not to, you know, sometimes people forget that and they look at the number and think that's how many, you know, were homeless for the year or something. That's not the case at all. So so we have. You know, we do a lot of planning that goes into the event before this point in time. We meet with outreach workers to identify where homeless people are staying, and then on the day of the count, we have street count teams that go out and hit those identified places to try and count as many people as possible. We also have our annual Project Homeless Connect event where we promote. This is going to be this one-day service fair where people can come and they get haircuts, they can get eye care, dental care, clothing, a hot meal, all that. So that, you know, to try and draw people in, both to get services and so that they can be counted for the time count. And we had teams riding the buses, counting people. We also, you know, use the HMIS system to get information from the emergency shelters and transitional housing programs. We can coordinate with the schools, the homeschool liaisons, they report their numbers that are staying, the homeless students and families at the schools. So we try to make it as comprehensive as possible and just count as many people as we possibly can every year. So let's look at the 2016 results. I'll talk a little bit about what you're seeing here. So that upper section with those first three rows, so those are the number of households, of families with children, and then the next row is the households without children, so that would be single people or couples that are over 18 without children. And then the last one is the households without adults, so those are just youth under 18. And then the section below that are the actual number of people, and that's broken out into these different age groups that HUD specifies to be able to play. So then the bottom section is the subpopulations where we have chronic homeless and veterans. So going across the columns, we have emergency shelter and transitional. Those are both the shelter populations. And then we have unsheltered. So those are people out on the street, in their car, under a bridge, any place that's not meant for habitation. We identify as unsheltered. And then to the right of that, we also have, just for a quick comparison, the unsheltered number from the previous year. So you can see that. That's generally where we see the most shift in the numbers because the emergency beds are pretty static. They're a set number of beds, so that number is always going to be about the same, more or less. And same with the transitional. There's some additional housing that comes up or closes for transitional housing, but otherwise, it's pretty much capped by what's available. So this year, for 2016, one of the changes, we had an increase in the number of families with children. On the back side of that page, you see the results from 2015. So there were 41 families with children counted this year, and last year there were 29. And the total people is higher, unsheltered people are higher this year than last year. There's 228 unsheltered people, and last year it was 206. So it's about a 10% increase from last year, which kind of, you know, confirms what I think would ever be suspected and what we're seeing is that we've seen an increase in the unsheltered population. The point in time count confirms that. It's not as high as other statewide, that's what other counties are reporting as well, that there's been an increase. I think in King County they were up as much as 20% this year. But so we have seen an increase in. Another change from last year, the chronically homeless individuals, if you look down at the subpopulations, this year was 27 and last year was 43. So we think there could be a couple factors going on there. We definitely have more permanent supportive housing for chronically homeless people, and that's a goal, is to try and get those people housed. And this actually, since the point in time count took place on January 28th, Lincoln Place was not open yet, so there was nobody in there. So next year, we should see even more of a decrease as those people are going to be housed. Another factor that could have influenced that was that HUD narrowed the definition of chronically homeless this year slightly. So part of the definition of chronically homeless is that they have to have a disabling condition, which is always the case, and then they have to have been homeless for a year or longer, or have had 3 episodes of homelessness within the last 4 years. Now, those 3 episodes of homelessness also have to total at least 12 months. So that's how they kind of narrowed it even more. So we could have seen some decrease just based on the narrow definition of the problem. And you don't automatically see the total here, but there were more veterans counted this year than last year. They split it into male and female, and you have to add up all the different two kinds of homeless shelters. But this year there were a total of 40 veterans, and last year it was 31. So there was an increase in the number of veterans as well. Yeah, well, that's been a primary focus of HUD and the VA. They have actually been increasing the veteran housing. So part of the squishiness of these numbers is that it's just self-reporting. And so sometimes, you know, people report themselves as veterans, but then we actually talk to them, they find out they don't qualify for housing or something based on their service record or their discharge status. And so, yeah, I mean, one of the projects that we're working on with the city and the county is to focus on getting this veteran list where we'll have them vetted through the VA who qualifies for services.
By name.
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
No, just by name.
By name. And then have outreach workers focus on them and coordinate getting them the housing. So we're going to have, I think next year, we'll have a much more solid number of the actual veterans.
And there's more housing coming online this year, so... That's veteran specific.
That's what
Freedom's Path will be at the end of this year.
Okay. So we also have a zip code report, but are there any more questions about the point right now?
Would you mind explaining the difference between the different homeless definitions that are used in our community?
Between like
Shelton McKinney?
So HUD's definition of homelessness does not include people that are doubled up, sort of couch surfing. You have to be literally homeless. So you have to be on the street or in a place not meant for habitation. So that's part of, sometimes we'll see a much higher homeless number because they're counting people that are doubled up, which is a very precarious situation that you're, at the mercy of whoever you're staying with. But so sometimes, we like to include those numbers as well, just because, those people need assistance dearly as well. There's different programs that they'll qualify for based on funding. So if they're unsheltered and literally homeless, or if they're doubled up with friends and family.
Transitional housing is also considered homeless in the eyes of HUD because it's not permanent housing. They have to move once they're done with the program. And that's same with shelters, so that's why those numbers are counted in that one-time count.
I have a question on the last page. Ooh. The last column, the last display, chart 2. It says by state, county, city. Is that people within this area within our group, and just saying that we had 37 people from California? Is that what this is saying?
Yeah, so let's go ahead and talk about that zip code report. So this is the most recent. About once a year, we try it, and we use the HMIS system to gather the last permanent zip code of any client who accessed our system in any way. So this isn't necessarily people who are housed. They could have gone to the volunteer lawyers program or whatever, and reported they had this last permanent zip code. So that's a HUD data standard, that last permanent zip code. And that's where they were last housed when permanently housed. So, This isn't where you would find them today, necessarily, but when they were last permanently housed, this was the zip code they lived in. And so, yeah, that chart one is a breakdown of all the different zip codes within Clark County. And then the chart two goes beyond that, because we have people who access the system. The last time they permanently housed was in California or New York. Or it's pretty amazing like how many states are represented there. So of course the biggest number is actual Washington, and then we break that down between Clark County and the number in Vancouver. And then outside of Oregon, of course, is the next highest number at 6%. So you know, that's 6%, but it's sometimes you hear, you know, people express an opinion that, you know, all of our homeless come from Portland or something, and that's, now you know it's actually 6%. So it's not 50. And that number has actually gone down. From when we first started doing this back in 2011, it was closer to 10%. And it's the percentage has turned it down over time. So, yeah, and then only, you know, actually 3.6.
Yeah, it'd be Portland, the 3.64.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, the other states, California, Idaho, Utah, Florida.
And that, is there any coordination of this data across the river? Or
of the data?
Yeah.
Not much. There's potential because we actually use the same HMIS software.
Yeah.
And so we have some programs that are shared. You know, like we have Impact Northwest, where they're located in Portland, but they provide services here and are data to both of our HMIS systems. But no, there's no real sharing. They're separate systems.
What we do see, though, is HUD does publish the point in time counts for all the areas nationwide. And this is a little bit different than what you're asking for. It's not direct coordination, but I think it's also important to highlight that because of the narrative of, you know, people are coming to, you know, they're the magnet of the services. They're moving here to access the services. And, you know, what we see are regional and national trends, you know, so we will be able to see, you know, for the 3.64% of people from Portland, you know, homeless people that present themselves for some service, not necessarily housing, from Portland, Portland's also going to see a certain percentage, you know, that came from Vancouver and came from other areas. And, you know, so what we have seen in Clark County in terms of increase in our point in time count about 10% is consistent with the national, with the state trends and national trends, and in many cases a little bit lower, you know. Yeah, so we do get to see that, you know.
So do we also analyze the data in terms of identifying needs and specific areas, like, you know, say the battleground and HMIS entries are primarily for food, and the Washougal might be for housing? I mean, do we analyze it across county to sort of see?
We have not, like, not in that manner that you're talking about.
We have before, just as a one-time snapshot, looked at, you know, for these people that have, you know, they have these needs from these zip codes, what were those needs?
Yeah.
And so we've done that before. We don't do that consistently every year, but we have done in the past.
It would be interesting, sort of like a needs analysis for different communities, the challenges and concerns per community.
Just remember, and this is not a reason not to do that. I think that can be very, very valuable and useful data.
Good student.
If you do it once, but even if you did it, and this is actually what I'm talking about, is against doing it, it's not something like a student project. If you do it once, it's nothing but a snapshot. You know,
right.
If you really want to do a needs analysis and, you know, a real analysis of the services, you have to have a methodology, you know, so you can see the use over time.
And you're only going to get a piece of the information because not all programs are turned to HMIS.
Right.
Across, you know, the county itself. So you just want to make sure that you keep it in context of what information we're getting. But we're moving more in that direction as far as with the programs that we fund where we do require entry into HMIS so that we can get a better idea of what's going on.
And it tends to get skewed in the system. If I were to run a report based on the needs that were reported by the programs, because the program only provides that specific need. So, like, if I pulled the needs from the volunteer lawyers program, they're all going to be legal related. It's not going to be food, or they may have additional needs that aren't being reported by the
But when you enter somebody into the system and there's an existing record and pulls up the data, you can see what other services they've accessed.
Yes,
so it is cumulative in that respect,
mm-hmm.
which is why we quit using it.
It would be interesting, back to this services attraction, it'd be interesting to take the state's data on driver license turn-ins and compare the percentage of driver license turn-ins to this list.
To see just the general population moving over. And
right.
I suspect you won't see much. These numbers won't be any higher than what a general.
Right. I bet you it looks very similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a definite misnomer that people are coming across the bridge to access services. And so we've used this to be able to kind of show that it's not necessarily happening at the rates that
Well, and there's and it's a two-way migration.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing to remember.
Absolutely.
You know, so it one thing is to say, oh, you know, 6% of homeless people here are have last zip code in Oregon. How many people in Oregon, you know, in the Portland metro area are presenting themselves they had their last zip code in Washington? You know, so the big takeaway, you know, in terms of data analysis is that the bulk, the center of gravity, are from Clark County, are from Vancouver. And that is a consistent, you know, what is the trend over years, you know, and it's the same center of gravity, it's the same basic thing. So like the local services, and you know, I think we can say from a very factual, you know, knowledge-based statement, our local homeless system of care is serving the local community.
In our overflow, we actually sent a call. You know, if there's not space in the shelter, you call them, they send you the call.
I think we walk a fine line here. We are such a data-driven society, and collecting data is expensive. I think we need to be very careful what data we need. Just like she said, she had to hire another person to do the HMS. That costs money that could be going to serving the ones who need the service.
Mm-hmm.
I see it in schools all the time, and I'll quote you something that the legislator required 38 major reports from OSPI a couple of years ago. Those 38 major reports start down in each individual school with each individual teacher, with each individual secretary, up through the district office, up through the ESD, up through OSPI. And when I ask a legislator, which of those reports did you look at? You know what their answer is, I'm sure.
No.
Now, how many dollars were spent collecting that non-use data that could have been put into the classroom? It's what I'm asking you. How many dollars are spent for accountability? And believe me, I'm all for accountability. But for what do we truly need to be accountable? How do we make our dollars work in the most efficient way possible, provide us with that data, and still not overwhelm or take away from the needs we have?
Oh, I completely agree with you. And there is a fine line. Now, you know, where I will push back, though, is, you know, there are two reasons to collect the data. One is compliance. You know, the reporting to your funders, the transparency, the accountability piece, got it, and that's important, I support that. The second one, where we should want data, is the results-based management. You know, is the adapting programs and systems to to meet the outcomes that the local community requires, you know, that respond to those system gaps. And we aren't going to have that ability without the information, you know. So, but it is a fine line.
I agree with you totally. We need data. We just need to make sure that what we collect is what we need.
Absolutely.
Well, and I think the point I was raising is, given that we have to collect the data, then what are new ways of thinking about using it?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
writing an algorithm for a computer program is way cheaper than starting from scratch. But I agree that the quantity of paperwork a food bank has to do, for example, rather than just giving away food.
Well, and continuing with that is, how then do we better serve people? And that's the cross-border conversation as well, that how do we get a fuller picture of the needs of an individual if they're getting services on both sides of the river and we're not coordinating the data. We're not coordinating the data, and we're missing opportunities to better serve.
And identify gaps in services here.
Well, I think you're thinking in terms of coordinating services for individuals and households that are receiving services at this, you know, in a given period of time from both sides of the river. I don't have information on that. I would be very surprised if I think that'd be pretty exceptional.
Most programs require some sort of identification.
Yeah, but we don't see that. You know, we don't see that the data. But I think that I'm sure those cases exist. You know, I mean, statistically, there has to be. You know, even if it's, but they've got to be outliers. I think most programs are really geared up. You know, to not just serve the local piece, but I also think the individuals and households receiving those services don't have the mobility and flexibility to access them, because really our service delivery systems are pretty rigid and pretty time consuming, and you know, you're not going to have an individual as a norm, on any level of norm, having the ability to you know, get food from food banks on both sides of the river, or you know, if you're getting housing, it's going to be on one side of the river. You know, case management and outreach. You know, I think that would be really, really low, but we don't have that data, so that's.
I just know if you phone Sheriff somebody the homeless referral system, and there is no housing and no emergency shelter here, you're sent to Portland, and are we tracking our shortage of capacity? So it's not a question of people ripping off the system, it's a question of what services don't we have here,
and we're looking at that data right now to determine we're trying to develop a profile of what's the next shelter we need.
Right.
Yeah, but we look
it's
at
not
the
easy data
beds.
Pulled together.
And I'd be curious to know if they actually make it there.
Oh, absolutely.
There are anecdotes that since implementing with Vancouver's still having a somewhat restrictive camping ordinance, and Portland having a more liberal camping ordinance, that people are walking across the bridge and camping at Jensen Beach at night and then coming back across the bridge to during the day.
Sounds good.
But that's just rumors and hearsay.
And that would make sense to me. they're probably not receiving many services in the Portland metro area though if they're doing that.
All right, thank you, Dale. A lot of information.
Thank you for having me.
How fast can you talk?
I can talk really fast. How fast can you listen? So we are doing our semi-annual financial report. Rhonda unfortunately came down with an illness and was not able to be here today, so she apologizes. But she did put together these fabulous reports. If you look at the biggest one first, that's the community funds programs. And this is going to be through 2015. So the majority of the programs should be completely spent out or very close to it. Sometimes there's a little bit of money left on the table. We then recapture that money and put it back into the 2016 funding. There are a couple of them that I wanted to point out that are not completely spent out and explain why. If you look down under Council for the Homeless, there's the landlord risk mitigation funds. These are in partner with the Rentwell program, and we're glad that these are not being used, because what these funds are used for is when a tenant completes the Rentwell program and goes into a private market apartment, the landlord can sign up for these funds. So if the tenant blows out of the apartment, causes damage, they can be refunded up to, I believe, $2,000. And so you could see that nobody came in for those funds, which means that those participants in the Rentwell program are doing a fantastic job and they're not causing damage or eviction fees and things like that. So that one, we want to see recapture that and then get that money back again. It's kind of a rollover program to make sure that it's always available for those that participate in the Rentwell program. If you look under Janice Youth, you'll see that there's the Landlord Risk Mitigation Fund. This was the different mitigation funds, ones that we actually funded for all of our housing programs. And it was essentially very similar. We pay for damage, eviction costs, things like that for somebody that blew out. And that was to make sure that we could keep that connection with the landlord and make sure that they would still rent to additional participants in our housing programs. Those again were come back into the county and redistributed through our 2016 contracts to fill those contract requirements. There's the Oak Bridge Energy Upgrades. This one is a completed project. This was that special RFA that we done back in 2014, and it was for agencies to come in and do specific upgrades to their buildings. So Janice Youth upgraded one of their shelters. They got a new HVAC system, insulation, I can't remember what else. Their bids actually came in under what they had anticipated the cost to be. So that $6,700 was then recaptured and put back into 2016 contracts. We've talked about New Day Community Dental Clinic many times, that they just weren't able to spend out their funds. The Youth First Program and Partners Careers, they just did not spend out the funding. They have been able to secure a lot of other funding through the schools and the Community Foundation of Southwest Washington. So we were able to recapture some of those funds. The Salvation Army Emergency Funds, this is a program that is specific for tenants or homeowners that are being evicted due to multiple code violations. And this is to make sure that they can secure housing right away and don't end up in the homeless system. So it's used every once in a while. It's just a pot of funds that we make sure is available in case that that happens. The Second Step Housing Preservation Fund is another one of those special projects that we did. They're currently working on doing several updates to many of their properties, new driveways, new kitchen, new flooring. There was a whole lot of different things. So they're working through that fund. That contract goes through the end of this year.
So this is, Second Step Housing, they own the...
They own many properties.
Okay.
Yes, and so this was to go in and do some upgrades that needed to be done. Under SHARE, the facility maintenance is another one of those special projects. So you can see they came in just under what they had predicted they would need to do upgrades to their shelters, mainly SHARE House. Mm-hmm. And then they have the Rentwell program. They just didn't have to use all of those funds through that. We now have them coordinating the Rentwell program for us. to Housing Authority is also the 2060 special funds for the improvements. They did several things at the YWCA Safe Choice Domestic Violence Shelter. They will be done with that stuff, those upgrades at the end of this month, so we'd expect to see them spending that money out pretty quickly. So those are the main themes and why there's any monies and any dollars not spent came back and were reallocated in 2016.
So what budget year did this cover?
So this is mainly 2015, but there are the contracts for 2014, 2015.
I just wonder when it begins. 2015 January?
Yes, calendar year. We put in the 2004 contract amount so you could see the differences in the total amounts that they had. You'll see that many of the programs received a 10% reduction in their contracts because of the economic downturn, and we just didn't have as many funds as we had anticipated. So many of the programs took approximately a 10% cut from their 2014 contracts.
So we just heard volunteer lawyers got.
That was their 2016
increase. So that will show up here.
Not in this report.
No, but next year.
Next year you will see.
Okay.
Yes. The smaller report is focusing on CHG and ESG funding amounts. CHG has CHG funding and HEN, which is the Housing and Essential Needs. These were different length contracts on this report, so it's a little bit more difficult to read. Under Council for the Homeless, the ESG intake and assessment, you'll notice that the contract goes through the end of this month, so they should be completely spent out by the end of this month. And the Aspire Pros program under SHARE is also one that is a year and a half program, and so they'll be spending a majority of their funds out for that program itself. And many of these programs, because we were trying to spend out, we came very close to spending all of the CHG funds that were allocated to us from the state. We did a little bit of shifting at the end to make sure we filled in and spent as much as we possibly could. Any questions?
Thank you.
Who
are you talking to fast?
We're
coming public here, right?
Okay, do you have any comments?
Questions?
Fantastic.
Do you learn anything?
Other business?
Well, go ahead.
Are you sure?
You have them all.
I know. So I provided copies of the finalized bylaws to add to your binder, so if you might make sure you grab a copy of those so you have the most recent version. I'll add the symposium to the July thing. We had a few board members that were able to attend the symposium, so I'll have them talk about it next time. May is Community Action Month, so you should have seen the proclamation done by Governor Inslee in your packets. This County Council is doing a proclamation next Tuesday, May 17th at 10 a.m. at the 6th floor public hearing. So if you can be there in support, that would be great. Lydia will be there to accept the proclamation. And then we'll see, many of us are going to the homeless conference this afternoon. And so we'll report back on that. We're heading out to Spokane, and then we'll see you in July.
Awesome.
Wow.
Look at that.
Moves to adjourn.
That's your second.
Someone second. Someone, please.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Photo time.
Did you get your picture?
No.
Oh,
yeah.
You're not in the picture.
I can take it.